You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to, I believe that this is episode 10.
Episode 10, I believe. Sure.
Episode 10 of Bloomberg Politics Podcast, The Culture Caucus. I'm John Heilman.
And I am Will Leach. We're together.
We are here in New York City for the second consecutive podcast where we're face-to-face. It makes me so happy to see you, Will. And you were looking fucking just smart today.
Well, you know, it's fine. I'm glad we're face-to-face because ordinarily, as you know, like Jim Morrison and Kurt Cobain at the start of their musical career, I would only do all podcasts facing the wall
right.
And not looking, because the crowd makes me very nervous.
Yeah, I know.
So, but now I've come out of my shell and I'm ready to talk on the podcast.
But because you're listening to this and because of the nature of podcasts, which are not really a visual medium, you can't see what I see right now, which is Will Leach in a dark suit, a white shirt, and a red rep tie. You look pretty much like a young Ronald Reagan right now.
I get that a lot.
Yeah, there's kind of like the GE days. This is kind of excellent. Okay, and I mentioned Ronald Reagan.
It's just because I have hair. I feel like I get away with so much in the worlds of media and politics and sports because I have hair.
You have excellent hair, by the way.
I do have excellent hair.
So Ronald Reagan, former president of the United States and also movie star, and it's a kind of good, like, not totally made up segue into the topic of this 10th episode of the Culture Caucus, because we're going to talk today about a movie that is, in fact, opening today. The day on which this podcast is posted is the opening day for this movie, and the movie is called Wiener. Let me say that again. The movie is called Wiener. It's not the story of Oscar Mayer.
Right.
It's not the story of the great all beef Frankfurters of Chicago. No, it's the story.
It is also not about peepees.
No, it's not about penises. That's true. Right. It isn't. Well, it sort of is.
Because
it's actually the story of Anthony Wiener. Former congressman from New York, where we are currently recording this podcast, and candidate for mayor after a rather infamous, everyone knows about it, scandal that involved his willy and a pair of gray underwear texted
the fact that we all, like, the minute you say
you
that, the image goes into the brain.
It
will happen forever.
You know about that. So, you know, the guy named Wiener, who had a scandal that related to his wiener, had to resign from Congress and then decided to run for mayor here in New York City. So the movie Wiener is an account of that campaign. And it is as we begin to discuss it, Will, we're going to talk about the movie itself. We're going to talk about the culture of scandal. We're going to talk about Anthony Wiener just as a character. We're going to talk about Huma Abedin, who is Anthony Wiener's wife and obviously the closest staff person in Hillary Clinton's orbit, has been for a long time and is right now on her presidential campaign. There's a lot to talk about this movie, but I think the place to start with is just how good it is.
Yeah.
It is an incredible, incredible movie, and I want you to explain why it was incredible. I know you had the same reaction as I did. We did not see it together. We really haven't talked about it, apart from we both acknowledge that we think it's amazing.
It is terrific, you know, and you know, I think generally when people talk about all-access political documentaries, The War Room is usually the first one that comes to mind. But imagine if The War Room, not only did they lose, but everything fell apart in the most public possible way. And one of the things, this movie is directed by Josh Krugman and Elise Steinberg. Krugman actually worked for the campaign, so he has a level of access in this that is staggering. Like, it reminded me a little bit, you know, we've talked about Mitt, the Mitt Romney documentary, which has a little bit of access, but this is, imagine if Mitt's family was falling apart while he actually had this kind of access. The amount of stuff that's in this movie and the way that all the things it has to say very, very understatedly about not only how campaigns are run, but how media works and kind of megalomania and families and marriages is the number of things that they capture in this movie. And while also still having the holy shit, I can't believe that's on camera moments. Right. And there's like a dozen of them right. in the movie. It's pretty staggering.
Right. So let me just say a couple things just to kind of – first of all, I should probably describe the movie a little bit. But let me say this first. This will be sound a little sacrilegious, right? The War Room is a great movie.
It is.
And it's you know, Pennebaker and Hedges, and it's great. And you watch it, and it's still an enjoyable thing to watch. But if you watched it next to this film – you would recognize, you would see the seams of the War Room. The War Room is actually a movie that Pennebaker didn't have that much access. He had very little access to the candidate. He had and the candidate and his spouse. It was really obviously all about James Carville and George Stephanopoulos and the War Room, the right. staff. No diss to that. It's a great, compelling movie that gives you a sense of what it's like inside the campaign staff of a troubled, ultimately victorious, kind of amazing presidential candidate on the political level. But it doesn't take you anywhere near inside the room with it. Really, it's not candidate-centric at all. You know, I work on, as you know, this thing called the circus, where we are much more candidate and spouse focused, and we try to get intimate moments with our candidates mm-hmm. and their spouses. And occasionally, you get a moment that approaches somewhere near the vicinity of like 20 moments in this right. movie. Right.
Oh, yeah.
For most documentarians, the a level of access that if you get one scene. One brilliant, really revealing, really genuinely raw human intimate scene with a candidate and his spouse, if you're doing a political documentary, mm-hmm. that's your movie.
Yeah.
That's your set. That's the, oh my God,
right.
the holy shit moment.
Right.
This movie has, as I said, not kidding, it has 20 of them.
Yeah.
And there are, this and this is helpful to do the setup of the movie. Anthony Weiner has his scandal, decides.
And that happens before the movie.
Before the movie starts. Resigns Congress. And then as an act of attempted political and personal redemption, mm-hmm. decides to run for mayor of New York City, which is actually the job he's kind of always wanted. He suggests in the movie that part of the reason he was doing it was for his wife, Huma, who he says in the movie felt like getting on with their lives, running for office was right. part of what getting back to normal for them was let's get back to our political ambitions. Let's move right. forward. So he runs for
a mayor. Notion that was very quickly disabused.
Yes. and then everybody knows what happened, right? There were more naughty texts. There was more sexting. There were more pictures. There were communications. There were, you know, again, no physical contact that we right. know of with any of these women that we know of, but multiple women, and they kept happening over the course yeah. of the campaign. So just to say, it is, as you said, it's a catastrophic campaign.
Right.
And it's catastrophic in the sense that it's the same sin now revisiting itself upon the family, the guy, as he's given it incredible access to his campaign videographer. And when I said that you see 20 scenes of extraordinary intimacy that, like most documentarians, would kill for one of, literally throughout the movie, every time something horrible happens, and Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin are in a room together confronting the horror of what it means politically, personally, emotionally, spiritually, the camera's there in every instance.
Every time.
And you sit there and say, I cannot believe that I'm seeing this. Like every door you want to be behind, this camera is behind that door. And that is why, just at first blush, the first time you watch it, that's the first thing you say is, oh my God, they got everything that you as a voyeur, and let's just admit we're all voyeurs in this area, as a political voyeur, they got almost everything. There's twice when Anthony asked them to shut the door and walk out.
But quite movingly, which I'd like to talk about.
Right. But basically, it's like, everything you would want, they deliver in terms of that level of, as I say, intimacy and in the room at the moment when you want to be in the room.
And, you know, when we were watching this campaign, you know, the question that everybody had, there were two questions that I found myself asking when the campaign was going on. First off, why exactly is he putting himself through this? And also, what must it be like to see? Like, I feel uncomfortable knowing the sort of details that's going on in their marriage among my friends. Like, I don't want to know that about them. The idea that this all happened in public and they had to, I remember at the end of the campaign, she stopped showing up at campaign events. The movie gets deep into that as to why. I remember watching at the time being like, oh my God, she's not showing up to events. What must be going on
right.
in that marriage? And this movie has all of that. And I think that is, I want to talk about her a lot because the irony of the fact that he wanted to do this campaign for her.
At least in part for her.
Of course. I mean, obviously, he has his own ambitions.
But he cites her, as I said, in the movie as, you know, again, back to our normal lives and what our normal lives
are. And they're campaign animals.
What our normal lives are is Anthony's the most ambitious person on earth. And I will say just quickly, and I'll let you talk again. I've known Anthony since I was 21 years old. We shared a beach house in Dewey Beach, Delaware, my first summer out of college. So I've known Anthony Weiner for a long time, and I say this without prejudice. He's just was what the like in a world where I knew people who were, you know, Julius Genachowski, who would go on to be the head of Obama's FCC. Mm-hmm. There was this Chuck Schumer staff, insanely ambitious people, right? Anthony was the most politically ambitious person I maybe have ever known, apart from a couple people who became president of the United States. Right. And so normal life for them was, let's get back to being ambitious and running for office again.
And it's worth noting, too, that, you know, one of the reasons they got so much access was because I think they thought this campaign was going to go well. And at first it does. Like, one of the great little quiet moments is for like the first 15 minutes, you can see what they were thinking by running. You could see, you know, the idea, like, this comeback story. New Yorkers love a comeback story. They love and he was so, he owned it in a lot of ways. You know, he wasn't evasive. He was willing, you know, one of these people, the things that people liked about him when he was a congressman is he took everything head on and he fought and he was willing to face anything that's thrown at him. And I think that's something that's consistent throughout the movie, much to his detriment.
Right. And Anthony is also just, and one of the things the movie captures early on is his degree of what made him appealing as a politician. Part of it is what you just said, Will, about him taking things head on. His brashness, his openness about his ambition, but also his energy. Yeah. You know, and you see him as a retail politician early in the movie, working the neighborhoods of New York City with great, extraordinary verve.
There's this wonderful scene where they show him working, I believe, the Puerto Rican Day Parade.
Right.
And they show, and I mean, he's just killing it, and he's doing fantastic, and they show a very sad de Blasio.
Schlepping down the street.
Yeah,
right.
No one's looking at him. And you see the energy and why he might have thought he was going to win.
Well, and then there's the moment where a poll comes out early in the race that has him in first place, and he's on the subway, and there are people around him on the subway who are reading headline news: Wiener's in the lead, and like the redemption is possible. And the people are looking up over their tabloids, the Daily News, the Post, looking up and seeing Anthony sitting there on the subway, and he's sitting there kind of going like, "Wow, this is like it. This is the moment that
this is what I thought was going to happen.
I'm on the subway and I'm on the front runner again. What?"
And you can also say too, and this leads into to me the most fascinating part of the movie, which is Huma. I feel like the access they have to her, you know, you can see too, having, you know, she's obviously very close with Hillary Clinton. She had been through this kind of war before and knows certainly firsthand how, if you have an energetic candidate, this stuff can be overcome.
Right. The ultimate lesson, you know, of her experience watching her matron, I guess you'd call her patron, whatever, Hillary Clinton, her kind of, you know, surrogate mother figure, and her husband, just always resilience.
Yeah.
If you are resilient and you are brazen and you are resourceful and you are willing to stick it out, you can overcome almost anything. That's the lesson of the great lesson of Bill Clinton, right? Of his entire career.
But it is a different world now.
It is a different world, and there are, you know, there are different doubles. Yeah. It's a different world.
And I don't mean so much judgmentally much as these stories can eat you alive in a way that they were able to fight off, particularly in New York.
Right.
Like the idea that this is happening in New York City.
It's the hothouse culture.
Yeah.
And it's also, I mean, one of the key things is that, and, you know, it's interesting that, you know, you think about, there was Gary Hart, right, where a sex scandal destroyed Gary Hart's presidential campaign in 1988. And mainly the thing that destroyed him, really, as much as anything, was the photograph of him and Donna Rice on the monkey business, right? Bill Clinton, there were doctored audio tapes, but there was no photographic evidence ever of anything. Of all the women we've ever talked about with Bill Clinton,
To this day,
there's no video. And what killed Anthony, as much as anything, and this tells you about the power of pictures, is those pictures that we referred to before. And now in this world of social media and this world of text messaging and the world of selfies and the world of sexy selfies or disgusting selfies, whatever you want to call them, it's the image, right? Because if it's just words on the page or even voices, it's different from seeing a picture of a guy's wiener.
Yeah, and particularly, too, you know, he talks about this in the movie, about, because one thing the movie gets a little bit into, but really kind of skirts about almost as, it just accepts it like air, is that he why he does this.
Yeah.
Like, why he sent those messages in the first place. He talks a little bit about how it felt like make-believe.
Right.
It didn't feel like real life
right.
in a lot of ways. You were just having, like, this virtual chat and right. so on. And the movie... I find that slight kind of interesting, but what I find really interesting is their dynamic and
yeah.
the idea that she clearly has accepted and forgiven, at least as much as she can, this about him. But what she can't ultimately forgive, or at least accept, which I think we see throughout the movie, is when the second ones come through.
Right.
And,
yeah.
and, you know, and we see, you know, imagine, we talk about the Hillary thing, imagine if someone, there'd been documentary cameras there
right.
for the day the Lewinsky stuff comes out,
right.
or the day, like, just imagine, like, what, right. like, that would be, they're here for this,
right.
and you see them, because they're political animals, not only dealing with it in a personal manner,
right.
but also in a, like, how mixed their personal and political lives are, to the point that I feel like for him, he's better at it.
Right.
He's better at being able to separate personal and political, whereas she or meld them together in a way that they're inextricable from one another, whereas she, you see it fray, you see, and to me the star of this movie is Huma Abedin's body language.
Yeah.
And throughout the movie you see her, she tries so hard, and, you know, it's funny too, because, you know, when he has that one famous press conference, the one that's hastily put together, that was live all across the country,
right.
and she spoke, and that was one of the first times she'd really ever spoken on camera.
First time she'd ever done a press conference. She
yeah.
ever stood in front of a microphone.
And she was poised, and she did well,
right.
but, like, the idea, like, this was gone by that point.
Well, just to say, I don't want to stop you on your
no.
role, but, you know, the moment before that press conference, there's a moment when they're in one of the offices at the campaign headquarters, mm. where there is a shot of the two of them in silence,
yeah.
and Anthony is in a chair, and she is standing up, and they have just received the word that Sidney Leathers has mm-hmm. come on the scene, this other girl, a woman from Indiana, blogger, who Anthony has had some kind of interchange with. It is Ingmar Bergman.
Yeah.
You know, they are in silence for what feels like an eternity. The shot goes on for a long time, and she... There is the amount of communication that is happening between the two of them in that room without a word being spoken. You talked about her body language, but his body
yeah.
language, and the oppressiveness of the silence, and everything that you can see, her pain, her anger, her sadness, her sense of resignation, her sense of foreboding about what's to
yeah.
come. All of it is there without a word being spoken between the two of them. And it is, again, I don't mean to sound like I'm like giddy about it, but it's just a staggering thing to see on it's raw. It is as real as anything you could ever see in the realm of a political documentary.
Eddie, you almost have to have this kind of environment for that to happen. You have to have him, you know, one of the things that's fascinating about him is whatever is going on, whether it's bad news politically or bad news personally, it all gets ground up into the churn of, we're in a campaign, crazy stuff happens, let's keep plunging forward, let's keep going, leading to this amazing scene where he is with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC, where he is in a side studio yelling at him and getting in this big fight on television in a way that he thinks he just did awesome,
right.
and she can't watch it.
Right.
And
I'll say something about that in one second. We should mention, by the way,
yes.
because we're already like, I don't know how far. How long are we into this podcast? 17 minutes. 17 minutes in, and we haven't even teased the fact that we have Barbara Morgan,
yes.
who was Anthony Weiner's communications director.
And is in the film.
And the face, and is the third most prominent person
yeah.
in the movie. She's going to be talking to us in a second here on the podcast, so we can explore some of that stuff with her. That scene, to me, the Lawrence O'Donnell thing,
right.
famous moment in the campaign,
right.
well into when Anthony's clearly in a downward,
yeah.
on
it's
a
over.
Downward trajectory.
Right.
It's all over. He goes on, because he can't resist doing television, he goes on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell on MSNBC. Lawrence is in Washington. Anthony's here at 30 Rock in New York City. So they're communicating over the satellite. Lawrence decides to basically stage a moment,
yeah.
you know, and starts hectoring
That's
Anthony.
That's not an interview.
No. He's,
yeah.
He says, what is wrong with you?
Right,
he keeps
right,
asking
right.
that question. You could see Lawrence was going for a TV moment
right.
there. What is wrong with you? And he's trying to psychoanalyze him. He's basically saying something is wrong. Something is fucked
right.
in your head, buddy. And Anthony parries and fights and is feisty, and they argue and they go back and forth. And it's really a moment in which neither one of them come off well. And it's just kind of... And I remember watching it live. Like,
yeah.
I remember when it happened, right? And I thought, man, both these guys are not coming off well. In the documentary, you then see, in Weiner, the movie we're talking about, you then see the next day Anthony in his apartment or in the office, I forget which, but watching the interview over and over again
he's
on his computer. And he's giddy, to use the word giddy again. He's thrilled with how
I got him.
With
I nailed
his performance.
Him.
Yeah. Look, and he's watching it with this smile on his face and watching it over and over. And she is standing to the left looking at him, watching the interview over and over again. I think as horrified
as
in that moment,
yeah.
in that moment as she was by any of the actual indiscretions,
No question.
All of which supposedly took place in the past. The timeline is still unclear about a lot of this, but almost worse than the sexting is seeing her husband revel in this kind of tawdry media moment. And she looks like just disgusted with him. And he even acknowledges it. He's like, he says something in the, about that, noting that he's, kind of this charges him up to see this performance and that she obviously finds it kind of yucky.
The question that's asked him is like, do you think she loves this part of the thing she loves about you? And he's like, actually, I think this is one of the things she loves in spite loves me in spite of. And I think that there's no question. And I think one of their marriage, which is still together,
still
married.
They are indeed.
And one of the things that is fascinating about that too is, you see them. As the campaign goes along, he's so kind of caught on it. You see her slowly start to recede.
But
it's a fascinating thing because she is also a political animal as well. Not for nothing, but she also starts to recede as it becomes a little bit more obvious that he's going to lose.
Well,
and there have been always been rumors about Clinton, the Clinton campaign, the movie Clinton campaign being involved in that. The movie makes no claims to that and seems to have no. There's access with everything else. I feel like they would have had access of that.
Well, there's a couple moments in which Huma mentions that she's talking to Philippe, meaning Philippe Reinus, Hillary's one of Hillary's main.
He's on the phone a couple times.
Yes, there's a few glancing allusions to the notion that. She is that the campaign is out there, or the proto campaign, because there wasn't a campaign then. But that Hillary land exists and has views about what's going on, and has wants her to behave in certain ways, and wants him to behave in certain ways. It's alluded to. It's there. You feel it. It's said. It pops up, but it's not a central focus, and you never meet anybody from.
But
from,
certainly,
from
he keeps trying to get her to be larger parts as it goes along.
Yes.
There's a very difficult scene where he is filming a campaign ad, and he wants her to do it, and she's like, "Do I look camera ready? I'm not doing this."
Right.
He has this cutting, devastating line as she leaves as they're about to walk out to the throng of cameras all waiting for them.
Just try to look like you're my wife.
He actually says, make sure you leave 10 minutes after me, otherwise people will get the illusion that you're my wife.
My wife, right.
And like devastating.
Well, I say this, just want to be explicit, there is no tone of criticism in my voice when I say this about Huma, but the scenes in which, when he goes to vote, on election day and she does not accompany him is just excruciating and painful. And no matter what you think about Anthony Weiner, and again, I understand why she didn't do it. I have enormous sympathy for her in this situation. So I'm not second guessing her decision, but just as a fact of seeing him push his son in the stroller off to the polling place and have to make excuses for why she's not there is again one of the wrenching things in this movie, is seeing that, and he's done it to himself, it's his fault, he's done it to himself,
and he is very self-aware, for a guy that is kind of in his tunnel of running and doesn't quite get really what's happening, he's still very self-aware, and he's not delusional, except for the fact that he thinks he's going to win, I think, as it goes along.
Right, but I'll take you to another scene, though, in this dynamic that I found incredibly compelling, which is as he's going to an election night thing. I believe it's election night. And Sydney Leathers, the aforementioned, has come. She's in New York.
She was on Howard Stern.
She was on Howard Stern. And Stern has provoked her or has prodded her to go show up at this rally. And she shows up, and the campaign knows that Sydney Leathers is at the rally. This is kind of a famous incident from the campaign, but people may or may not remember it. But Sydney Leathers appears, and so no one wants to get in the picture with Sydney Leathers, right? So they know where she is, and they figured out an alternative way for him to get in.
They run through a McDonald's.
Running through a McDonald's, up some backstage. But here's the thing. As they're going there, you're in the car with Anthony and Huma, and Anthony's intention is Huma and he are going to go to this rally together.
Not just but also it seems that this was the one, he was okay with her not doing anything else.
Right.
But when he conceded,
Right.
He needed her to be
there. He wanted her to be there, right? And so they're in the car. She's going to go along with it. You can tell she's bracing for this being not just a depressing scene, but a scene where they're being stalked by this woman, and that it's going to, she's like, I will not, you know, I'm not going to allow myself, my dignity to be dragged in the gutter and be seen with this woman. I'm not going to interact with her. Obviously, totally reasonable on Huma's part, but you're getting closer and closer to the event, and they're in the car, and then there's a moment where finally Anthony realizes what's obvious to anybody who's watching it, which is that this is a complete fucking shit show. That's
the
about
fever
to
breaks,
and he looks at her and says, "Don't get out of the car.
Right.
Don't. You know, a moment of a small moment of humanity and redemption in a way, because you know he really wanted her to be there, and he realized like, no,
I can't do this.
This is all so tawdry that I'm gonna turn to my wife, who I really want to be here, and say, don't get out of this car. Yeah. I'll deal with this on my own.
And
sprint through the McDonald's. While she chases him, Sidney Leathers chases him through the McDonald's the McDonald's restaurant. I mean, unbelievable.
It really is an unbelievable thing. And so I'm curious, you know, having watched it, and you know, we've described some of the scenes. Do you feel like at the end of the movie, they almost feel actually like a functional couple? Like certainly in the hothouse of this kind of insanity, but there's still a respect between them.
Right.
I think there's still an unspoken
bond
between them that I think is real. And it's fascinating to me what happens next. First of all, what do you think happens with him now? Do you think he's done?
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean done as a functional member of society,
right.
But I mean, do I think he has a political future?
No.
I do not. Right. I don't. Because Anthony is so tied to New York. He's he's from here. He is so New York. I mean, he oozes New York out of his pores, and I just don't imagine that they're given, especially given, as you pointed out rightly before, the very special and specially trying, taxing, relentless media culture in New York. I just don't imagine, there's not a way in which you can imagine him, what's he going to run for here, given this history? You know, I just don't think that,
Well, this is proof he can't.
Right. Exactly right. So I think, I think Anthony will he's a very, very smart guy, and we'll have a
TV personality.
We'll have a fine career going forward, but I don't think that he has a political future going forward. The question that I wanted to ask you, though, is whether, if you watch this movie, let's just say this. In addition to all of the access and all of the kind of startling degrees of intimacy and revelation and so forth in terms of what you get to see in this movie, like the inside workings of a campaign. And I'll say that also, not just in terms of the marital issues, but just Anthony talking to the staff. I mean, actually, I think, again, very admirable moment. There's a moment where Anthony sits down with his staff and basically says, in a very adult way, I know you might be pissed at me.
Yeah.
You were here to vent. Do you have questions?
And
issues? Tell me what. Yeah. And you get to see him in a kind of very he steps up and basically says, come on, bring it to me here. We'll talk this through. The inner workings of the campaign are also very vividly detailed. The staff, the communications challenges, all of the people that are around them, the various, it's a fantastic look at the inner workings of a mayoral campaign in New York City. But here's my question. My question is, in toto, if you watch this thing, do you feel like, do you think that Anthony comes off well? Do you think he comes off poorly? Do you think he comes off some mixture? Like, what's your takeaway here for people? Will they think better or worse of him or what? And what? And the same question for Huma. Like, when you see this, is this, what's the portrait in full?
I think that if you already think that he's just some scumbag of a person, as apparently a lot of people do, I don't think the movie will do anything to dissuade you of that fact. But I also think that the movie shows his fierce intelligence and shows him as like an ambitious but not completely heartless human being.
Right.
And I think that one of the things that I think the movie does a really good job of is showing why you can see that he was a good politician. You get a sense of the potential that's been thwarted because of this. Because without question, you see why people liked him. You see why he admired him. You see why he was uniquely talented in a lot of ways. And the movie doesn't do a great job. I don't think it tries to do a great job of really getting into why would you send these pictures? What are you doing?
Yeah.
But I don't think it needs to, because I think that like it's really about more than. And for her, I have to say she comes across. She keeps her dignity in this throughout, in a way that frankly would seem impossible.
Right. I think that, you know, I've said as much to Anthony himself in an effort to get him to come on this mm-hmm. podcast, which he, for obvious reasons, or at least for understandable reasons, has decided he's not going to see the movie, and he's not going to talk about the movie. And so that feels like I'm not, you know, he doesn't want to give it more publicity. He does not seem to me, I will say, you know, just to general characterize this conversation generally, doesn't seem really angry, doesn't seem bitter mm-hmm. about it, understands, you know, why people are interested in the movie, but, you know, has just a very basic posture. Just doesn't want to bring more attention to it, so has decided he doesn't want to talk about it, and he's not going to see it. So I understand all that. But I've said to him, and I've said to everybody, I think it's not an unsympathetic portrait of him. I think no one could see this movie, and I think, see this movie and think worse of him than they already do.
That's absolutely true.
You know, there will be many people who, as you said, there will be some people for whom it does nothing to make them like him more. But I don't think there's anything in it that makes you think, God, I thought he was horrible, and now I think he's X times more horrible. I don't think that's true at all.
I agree.
And I agree. I think one of the great puzzles of Anthony, frankly, and I don't love totally psychoanalyzing someone with whom I've been friendly for a long time, but I do think one of the great puzzles about him is to key in on something you said, Will. He is incredibly intelligent. And he is incredibly self-aware. And those two things don't always go together. He's both. I mean, and people will say I'm nuts when I say he's self-aware, but he really actually is very self-aware. And how that self-awareness sits alongside, like right alongside, snuggled up with this utter blindness right. about the potential consequences of his behaviors and apparently a complete incapacity to control certain impulses. It just speaks to the really, really deep complexity of human beings that because he is really intelligent, really ambitious, really self-aware, and also, you know, compulsive
and self-destructive and
blind. You know, all of them, all of it together. He's really is. And I think the movie, one of the great strengths of the movie is it does capture him in his totality. And with her, you know, she is a tragic figure in this movie. I think she maintains extraordinary degrees of composure and grace under pressure. And yes, I mean, I said before, you can see in some places her anger, her simmering anger. You can see her heartbreak and her humiliation. But there's not a moment in it where she seems like Lady Macbeth to me. Not a moment where she seems, you know, there's a couple times when she kind of, you know, says things that any political person would say, you know, like, look, you know, make sure you smile, you know, like this is important for optics. But those are like, you know, just those are trivialities.
And there's also
in general, she does not come across as some crass opportunist manipulating situation. She seems like really like a woman who is supporting her husband in a way that very, very few women, if their husbands did to them what Anthony did to her, would be anything like as supportive or have the kind of forbearance that she exhibits in almost every frame, although they're not frames in this movie, but in almost every metaphorical frame of this film. I find it kind of astonishing.
Particularly because, remember, you know, with the campaign, she was integral to the campaign from the beginning because she needed to be out there. She had to be out there. He needed to be able to point her to her and say, look, this woman who is awesome still loves me.
Right.
She still loves me, and she's here, and she's supporting me, so we can all get through this together. She was key to it. And so the idea that she would agree to this and be key to the whole thing and have it go in the worst possible way and still not only keep her dignity, but also keep her family together it's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Do you think, let me ask you one last thing. We should get on to Barbara in a second here, who I'm sure will be appearing magically in her chair momentarily, but let me just ask you about this. Do you think watching the behavior, one of the press is obviously the other big, another big character in this film, and you know they're omnipresent and they, you know, play as they always do in campaigns, but in this one in particular, it's New York, etc. Do you take anything away? Did you watch this movie and think, God, the press is conducts itself poorly, conducts itself well, conducts itself surprisingly? Is there anything about the media element of this that stands out for you in watching it?
I think that in a perfect theoretical world, they would do what Anthony wants them to do, which is to focus on the issues and to talk about what matters to the people of New York. But the idea that world was ever going to exist in that campaign, so for me, is just ludicrous. And so the idea, certainly, I wish that the press would have focused on what was important for the city of New York. But let's not be crazy. The idea is Anthony Weiner, who is known for this massive thing, is running for mayor. It is quite reasonable that any press person would be like, why should we trust you?
Right.
Why did you do this? Are you going to do this again? Particularly after he's told us that he's done and then comes out. There's not a question. I might quibble a little bit with some of the overtly – not just confrontational, but performative questions that I felt like a lot of people were asking.
Right. Sure, sure.
But the questions themselves, I think they were very fair to be
asked. Yeah, I agree with that, especially since, you know, one of the things, and again, we talked to Barbara about this, but like the fact that, you know, that the things that reporters want, you know, and in the case like this, you know, you can't not want them, right? This is now, you know, this is a key to this guy's character and key to this guy's the issues of trust, as you said, and issues of veracity. The fact that the timeline and his inability to answer basic questions like, you know, when did this happen? Yeah. When did it start? When did it end? How many are there? Right. You know, the fact that those things even to this day, I mean, I'm not like a PhD level scholar in wienerology, but to this day, I don't believe that people have ever like really gotten to precise answers to any of those questions.
And no one should know under the importance of that more than him.
Right. Yes. And so I think, you know, the press is pretty ferocious in this movie and is certainly omnipresent, and you know, New York reporters are more aggressive maybe than any reporters in the country. But I looked for it thinking, oh God, you know, like there's going to be some horrific things, and God knows, you know, the stuff with Sydney Leathers and the way in which she transforms herself from the way in which she kind of glories in what she claims to have been a victimization, and then suddenly turns and then she, you know, sells herself into a porn
and
star
and then is literally chasing him.
Yes, and then is literally chasing him. But again, like the quick transformation of like, I'm going to sell him out, I'm going to out him, I'm going to claim that I'm a victim, and now I'm doing a porn film with a fictional version of Anthony Weiner is
and
just
and then chase him on his concession speech.
Yes, I mean, there was a little bit of that in Jennifer Flowers, right? You know, I mean, that's not new to this era, but again, the completely admixture of social media and the celebrity culture that glorifies, at least for a brief moment, pretty much anyone, right, who can like kind of present themselves in a certain way and make themselves part of the story. That's a little new, right? The tabloid culture has become everything in some ways.
Is it new or has it become nationalized?
Now? Well, I think that's it. That's what I mean. That is what I mean. What I mean is we had the tabloid culture for a long time
in New York.
But but the way in which it can blossom, and the number of platforms on which it can blossom, and the way and the speed with which you can go from, you know, from point A to point Z, is quite staggering, and you really see it in this movie in a pretty stunning way. So.
So go see it. That's the point. Go
Weiner,
it.
It's going to be. It's coming out today on Friday,
and then it's on Showtime. I think it's a 2-week run, and then I think it's going to be airing on Showtime.
Right. You got to see this movie if you're interested in politics at all, and if you're interested in good documentaries, and in particular if you're interested in both. You got to see this movie. I mean, there's no one who will watch it and feel like you wasted the hour and a half that you spent watching it.
It is one of two truly great documentaries we've seen this year, and we may actually talk about the other one next week. So.
Oh, that's going to be really exciting. That's you're talking OJ, right?
I'm talking OJ.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Will, where can you like? I know if you're listening to this podcast, you already know where to find it because you found it, but we should probably say, where can you find this podcast?
Well, we encourage everyone to subscribe to it on iTunes and give us a nice review there. It makes it a lot easier for people to find it. You can also find it on SoundCloud and, of course, on BloombergPolitics.com.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to take a little break, and we're going to bring in Barbara Morgan, and we'll get into some of these issues in a little more depth.
Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
And we're back with the 10th episode, the second half of the 10th episode of the Culture Caucus, Bloomberg Politics podcast on the intersection of politics and culture. I'm John Heilman.
And I am Will Leach.
You're still Will Leach. Even after that little intermission that we had, you're still Will Leach. That's awesome.
We all change a little bit every day, but I change a lot.
Yeah, I know. So this is the Weiner episode. We've been talking about Weiner, 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 nothing but Weiner all day long. And we're excited, thrilled, and lucky to have one of the stars. There, you know, there's Anthony Weiner, and there's Huma Abedin, who get a lot of screen time. But the person who gets the third most screen time in this movie is Barbara Morgan, who's here with us.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Barbara.
Hi, guys.
How's it going?
Good. How are y'all?
We're great. Barbara was the communications director, spokesperson, high-level senior advisor to the Weiner for Mayor campaign, and is a big, as I say, the third most prominent and character in the Weiner documentary. So she's got a lot of screen time, and I will say at the outset that she comes across incredibly well in this movie as someone who is like facing a huge amount of pressure and a huge amount of turmoil, and yet manages to maintain her grace and composure throughout. So congratulations for that, Barbara.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You've seen the movie.
I have seen the movie.
So you're the highest profile person in the movie who admits to having seen it.
Yes.
Because no one else will. Because Anthony Weiner says he's not seeing it and will not see it. And I think she's staying out of it altogether. What was it like? When did you see it first? What was the experience like watching it?
I saw it a couple months ago.
Okay.
I think that the experience it's surreal. Obviously, it's, you know, we all lived this. It's quite another thing to then see it cut into the snippets that it is. You know, you obviously have the gut reaction of, oh my gosh, I cannot believe I wore that outfit. What a terrible outfit choice. That was stripes with that color. Gosh, what was I thinking? It looked so cute walking out the door. I'm clearly a moron. But then it's also if you go back and think about the length of the campaign, it's about 4 months long. And anyone who works on campaigns can tell you that the days are very, very long, probably typically between at least 16 and 18 hours most days, typically 7 days a week. If you get off one day a week or get a 10-hour day here and there, that's pretty great. So all in, you're probably looking at around 2,000 hours that we worked. And then you have a filmmaker who gets about 400 hours of footage, I think that he's said in interviews that he's, that he had documented. And then the movie's 90 minutes long. So, and half of that is cuts from other portions, like from the media's perspective and from other things. And you recognize that there's just so much else that happened during this time frame. But then it's also a fascinating perspective of what was taken out to be able to tell, a perspective on what happened during that time period.
Totally. So did it feel, so having it truncated, not truncated, but edited together that way, put the way, did it feel like it got the heart still of what happened?
I think that I think it gets it to the heart of what the role and intersection is of media in the political process. I think that there's untold story, if you will, of just the fact that the staff was a really incredibly talented, hardworking staff. And quite frankly, Anthony did really, really great things during the campaign. I think that there was a great focus by our team and Anthony on substantive issues and really focusing on that. People forget that after all this stuff happened, we still put out a second policy book, right? That the team still focused on that on a day-to-day basis. And there was still daily or every other day press conference where we focused on one of our ideas in a neighborhood where it would matter to constituents. And then that was still something that we were very focused on. So that doesn't necessarily go into it. It's about the questions that people want answered and what that looks like.
Yeah, but I think one of the things we talked about earlier is that I think one of the things that the movie does well is two things. One of the things that has two subpoints, one of which is that I think the staff in general comes across really well. You come across well. I think everybody comes across well, and under very trying circumstances. I think everybody comes across as trying to stay focused on issues, trying to deal with a circumstance that they never anticipated being in or couldn't fully anticipate being in, even though some of these things, maybe were a little predictable. And then secondly, I think it also gets across the extent to which Anthony was, why he was a compelling, talented figure. It gives a very good sense of his retail skills early in the movie. It gives a sense of the way in which he connected with people, why this guy was ever a promising figure to begin with. So I think the movie, actually, part of the reason why it's good, and I'm going to ask you in a second what you think of the movie itself, but from our point of view, I think when we were talking about it before, that's part of why it's powerful, right? Because it's not just he's a scumbag and he's self-destructive and he's a lunatic, but this guy had a lot of chops and he had good people around him, and yet he was also a ticking time bomb. So, but do you like this movie? Do you think this movie is a good movie?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I absolutely agree with you on all of your points about why it is a compelling movie. I thought it was from an objective standpoint when I could as much as I can remove myself from, me cringing at the sound of my own voice. I thought it was a great movie. I think it's because I think it's an it's a really interesting take on how we consume information, the role of the media, and how campaigns and or politicians react in that space, right, as well as campaigns or politicians that have a fundamental flaw.
Right.
It's a really interesting movie, and I I think it was done really well.
So let's just step back for a second and just do like a little bit of like set you up a little bit here, right? How did you get involved with the campaign? You had been doing what and you were offered this job? Like what was your background like leading up to when you were offered the job? And what did you see when you were offered it? What were the considerations that led you to take it? And maybe whatever, if you had some reservations, what was on the pro side of the balance sheet? What was on the con side? Like just take us back to that moment when you took the plunge.
Yeah, that's a lot of questions, so I'm going to take them one by one.
Yeah, sure.
So I had previously been working, doing communications and government with a focus in education, and I spent about 6 years doing that. And it actually happened over, quite frankly, a random conversation with a friend here in New York who mentioned to me that he heard Anthony was looking for a communications person. And it, as nerdy communications people do, they delve into the conversation about, oh my goodness, what a great communications challenge, because if you lived in New York City, you knew of Anthony. And I, in one of my roles working at the New York City Department of Education, I'd actually been the director of federal legislative affairs for a couple years. And so I interacted with his office. And
when he was in Congress.
When he was in Congress.
Right.
And I can say that they were both the most, they were the biggest pains, but also my favorite people to work with, because his district team was... They would not let anything go. They were like, we have a constituent issue. We want to know about this. We want to know about that. How do we fix this? And I found that, you know, both for my job, slightly annoying because, you know, I'd already given them an answer 7 times. But
they were engaged.
But they were engaged. And I thought that that was a really great reflection of him as a representative, that he like felt that this was, you know, because it's a clear directive coming from him, that they were that engaged with their work and fixing the issues in for their constituents.
Right.
So because of that, when this comes up, and obviously we had all watched it in 2011 when the scandal had happened and he'd resigned. And, you know, the idea of how do you take somebody who is really smart, really talented, has a lot of great potential, who constituents really like, and who went through this really, it is a scandal, a bad decision, all of the things that went around with it. And is there a possibility from a communications perspective to retell that story? And from someone in our field, that is what we do. We tell stories and we shape narratives and we get the points out that we think are really important. And that was very interesting. And, you know, and so it was just really just a conversation about that. And, you know, my friend happened to say, now that I'm thinking about it, maybe you might be a really good fit for this. You'd been wanting to move into, you know, a more general sector anyway, and not only focus on education anymore. Maybe I should set you up for a call. And it was a few phone calls with Anthony later and a couple other conversations, and I had signed on board.
So you had never done a campaign before, or you had done a campaign before?
I hadn't done a campaign as a paid staffer.
Right.
I'd volunteered.
Right. So this was going to be your first, as a communications professional, this is going to be your first campaign engagement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And did you, you know, in your various conversations with him, you know, obviously one of the questions that anybody would have had was, or like many people I would expect you might have had, was this thing happened? Do I have anything to worry about in the future?
Like any surprises?
How much self-vetting went on in terms of like people being candid with him and saying, Anthony, if there are other incidents like this that we really need to know about them? I mean, was that discussed as you headed into the campaign?
You know, and it's funny, we did, there was a... after the campaign ended, after the general election in 2013, there was a round table with a number of staffers, and this question was actually brought up. And what was interesting is that if you go back and look, no one asked those questions, because Anthony talked about it and said, I suspect there's other information out there that could come out. He said the same thing, and I think that so we both knew that, but it was, I think the difference here was simply the timeline, that people didn't recognize that difference. And so I think that we did ask those questions in a way. During that roundtable in 2013, someone brought up the John Edwards answer around, you know, how he had spoken about things, that what if you didn't ask the exact question, the answer was still the same thing. And so, yes, there was still information out there. So I think that
I didn't.
I, you know, and that's one of those things about asking questions about what are the type of questions that you need to ask. And I think that I probably err on the side of being the most annoying communications person ever now, because I ask a lot of questions. Well, what does this mean for you? What does, you know, what is the impact on this? What's your objective? What are you trying to get out of this? You know, and give me the timeline, give me the breakdown. What, you know, when did this happen? When did, you know, in certain circumstances, because I think it's really important now to have that information in order to tell the whole story.
Right. So let me just ask this question, then I'm going to turn you over to Will. But like, in the abstract, you knew like that Anthony had said, well, you know, this the things that people know are about from the scandal are not the only things. There may be other things out there, but you knew in the abstract there might be a problem that could pop up, but you assumed it would be something that would be contextualized by saying, this all happened before the scandal. This was all back then. That's ancient history. You didn't litigate like a litigator with him about, like, let's have a really, like, you know, like, detailed discussion of exactly what the timeline is, which is, you know, ended up being obviously a huge problem, right?
That's and it happens in the movie.
Yeah, like, that's right.
There's the scene in the movie where, like, you're trying to nail him down on, when you're in the car, and you're trying to nail down, okay, so how many are there, when are they, and he seems to even be giving you vague answers. I'm wondering if there's even a question of this, of the idea that he really thought, did they really think going into this that they were done with that? Or that, like, after, because, you know, this
by
is...
By they, you mean Anthony and Huma?
By Anthony and Huma, and really the whole campaign. Yeah.
Right.
And along those lines, too, you know, there's this sense in the movie where things seem to be going really well, and, like, you guys get over the hump, and did it feel like at that point that it was behind you, that it was over, that part of dealing with the Wiener story was done?
I think so. I think that we knew going into it that it was going, that we were going to have to, you know, this immediate, you know, the immediate conversations were going to be about that. And then how do you then pivot back to what we wanted to talk about, which were the issues that were facing people in New York City and the things that they actually wanted to focus on. And so, yeah, we did feel like we got to a point where we were on a day-to-day basis, that's what we were actually focusing on, which for a campaign that was based around ideas and issues, that felt really good to us. And it felt like Anthony says in the movie, you know, thought things were going pretty well there for a moment. You know, I mean, I think that that's, you know, I think we all felt that way. You know, there was a lot of momentum and we felt good about where we were.
The initial story that you see in the film when the first story comes out, and there's this Cindy Leathers thing and all sort of, or that woman or whatever the nickname they have for her in the movie. I forgot.
Pineapple.
Pineapple, yes. When you see her come up, there's a sense of shock and... But also, did you see this as a media problem, or did you see this as a fundamental? Is this a, we need to spin this the right way, or did you see that immediately as this a potentially mortal threat to the campaign?
I can be really honest and say I don't know if there was that high level thinking at the moment. Yeah. I honestly think that at the moment it was, as the head of communications, you are then faced with both the day-to-day of... We're still running a campaign, and so we still have to do Facebook posts of our visits to senior centers. We still have to do all this. I still have to approve all copy for that. I still need to have, like, you know, my team doing that, as well as setting up, making our poster boards every day and making sure our graphs are correct for the press conferences we're going to do, as well as deal with the incoming hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of emails from the media around this issue, too. So it became very much... How do I do all of these things all at once? And I think the staff was doing that too. And we were really just trying to keep the trains moving, as opposed to saying, let's have these higher level thoughts about whether or not this is going to put us in a position where we are never going to be able to recover, or can we keep moving as well as deal with this in the same time.
Right. One of the things Will and I talked about earlier is the behavior of the press. It's New York City, right? There's no more intense...
I think that's one word to put it.
intense, ferocious, operatic, sometimes skeevy kind of press environment. In any, I don't know of one that's more any of those things.
Boise's close.
Right, Boise. Apart from the local municipal press in Boise, Idaho, this is the craziest. So just reflect on that for a moment, right? You had to deal with the press day in, day out, national press, local press. Just as you think back on it, what were the elements where you think the behavior of the press was most irresponsible and where the press was most responsible? Because in some ways, it strikes me that, you know, beyond the usual New York press scrums and people just behaving like assholes, like on a kind of like just like micro level, it didn't seem to me that there were incidents captured in the film, at least, where the press was like really wildly out of line. although I'm sure there are places where they were, because it's New York City,
and it must
just
have felt
kind of inevitable.
That way, I'm sure.
So yeah, so like just well, like what was you, just describe your interaction with the press corps and where you thought like they fell down on the job and where you thought they actually were kind of responsible if there were any instances where that was the case.
So I want to say first, I think that I have great respect for the New York City press corps. I think that they have really hard jobs. I think that the pressure that's put on in this media market is very different than every other. I absolutely recognize that they have jobs to do, and they, you know, I consider a great number of them friends, and that we also respect the fact that when I have on my work hat and they have on their work hat, that is, you know, you try to compartmentalize. But I have great respect for them. I think that they do a great job on the whole, on a regular basis. I think that there is also the reality of the business, which is you sell your content, and therefore your content has to be the content that gets the most clicks, that sells the most papers. And so you have to find the angle, the scoop, the headline that does that. And that leads to a lot of times
a lot of wiener jokes is what that leads to.
Right. I mean, well, there's that. But I think that it's also about chasing information that is absolutely untrue. I spent a lot of my time trying to prove a negative, which was this is absolutely not true. And yet I can't prove it because there's no proof to prove it. Because
physically impossible.
Right. It is actually impossible, like in this world, to be able to prove it. And having to do that on a regular basis is very tiring. I think that it takes a lot of energy. That was, I think, one of the things that I felt was most egregious. That happened regularly,
right.
And it was chasing things down because I had to be able to even
sure.
try to prove something. I and or my staff took I love cameramen, but like, man, I took way too many cameras in the head. I think that I have some really good scars, but I think that it's stuff like that. It's just about, I recognize that this, and in those moments when you're in those scrums, like, I get that this is your job, but that doesn't mean you have to be rude to
right.
me. I think that there's still a level of decorum that people should try to maintain. That wasn't always there.
But let me just ask you this, just because I think this gets to the core of the question, right? As you said a second ago, no doubt, I'm sure you spent a lot of your time trying to prove a negative, going down rabbit holes that, the press were making accusations that were based on very little. It seems to me that the fundamental problem for a communications professional in your situation at that moment is that you're working for someone who has done this kind of egregious thing and then is perceived, not inaccurately, to have kind of lied about it, right? And so the question that comes up in the movie, often you hear a number of reporters ask this question to Anthony. It's like, well, how can we ever trust you again? You said this, this was an isolated thing, it was in the past. Now it turns out it's not really in the past and it's not really an isolated thing. How can we possibly ever believe? How can the voters ever possibly trust you again? And that's a big, huge, important political question. But also for the person who's being his representative in the press, it's part of why you can't really just say, it would seem to me, well, of course, that's obviously untrue. That's ridiculous. I'm not going to even dignify that with an answer, because at this point, it's like, well, really, why? Like, you're not going to dignify that with an answer. You're not going to, why is that obviously untrue? You have the problem of having to represent someone about whom there are fundamental questions about their judgment and about their honesty.
Right. And I think that that's, that was something that in that scene where I think that those were regular conversations that we had, like with the scene in the car where I said, well, I think that we have to say this because of this. And I think that that's something that as a professional, I will blame myself for on that campaign. The idea that at some point didn't say, all right, stop. We have to get, we have to answer exactly like this in this way, because this will be what stops the questions. I think that the not knowing about what will actually, hindsight's 2020, you have no idea. The New York Post and the Daily News are still going to continue to ask those same questions, regardless of what you say, and you'll still be continuing to fight those battles. I think that as a professional, I will say that was probably my responsibility to say, let's put a pin in this right here, where we need to get everything answered right now, so that all the questions just keep asking the same thing, as opposed to, but wait, we still need to know this and still need to know this, so that we get that answer of, why should we believe you? Because I've told you this is what it is. And I think that people just felt like there was still there was still tension in terms of trying to get those answers, and that was probably my fault if I, you know, if I said like those first 2 days to take that time to do that. But, you know, I think that that's something that, you know, you can look back and say, I wish I'd done it this way, and right. I wish I'd done
well,
it this way.
You know, another factor in this too, and one thing that there's been a lot of speculation because of Huma, and because of her connection with the Clintons, and is for two things. One, is it harder to ask those questions when the spouse is such an integral part of the campaign? She's clearly very, pretty involved. She has a lot of political history. He even talked about how one of the reasons that he ran was to get their life back to normal and get her back in the political arena. And two, so I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about, there's been a lot of speculation about, you know, the Clintons in the movie are like the Clinton world, Hillary world is like this quiet, like every once in a while, you'll get a call from the campaign and they'll pop in. But on the whole, they're more just kind of watching what's going on. So I guess my two questions are, one, were they involved at all? Did you have any interaction with them? And two, is it harder to have those conversations that you need to have because the wife is such a big part of the campaign?
I'll start with the second question because I think that it speaks to me having not worked in this role on a campaign before. I don't know if that's any different or any, you know, if that's what that looks like. I think that there are, you know, from my friends who have worked on campaigns, there's typically somebody who's assigned to the spouse, and that is actually something they, you know, direct the role of that person. Not that different from, I think, the other campaigns that were happening in, you know, in the city, or, you know, the other candidates in the city. I think that it was expected that she would have a role and that she would be involved in some way, depending on other obligations that she had at the time. And that's how we treated it. From my perspective and my experience, it wasn't difficult to have those types of conversations because candidates have opinions. Obviously, their spouses have opinions because it's also their life, right? It's, you know, it's not just, you know, when you're running for public office, it's not just that person's life. It's the family's life too. And so we fully expected her to have an opinion, but also she happens to be brilliant and she has great perspective on how to deal with, you know, long slogs of campaigns. She's lived that too. She is the spouse to the candidate. She has great insight on the things that matter to him that might not be apparent to me right away, but then, oh, you said that. That makes sense, actually. Oh, that's interesting. That's a different way to approach this. To the first question, no. I mean, we were running a campaign in New York City that, you know, most people in New York City during a primary in the middle of the summer aren't paying attention, much less anybody else in the rest of the world. So, no. I think it was, we had our team and we were focused on that, and that's what we were doing on a day-to-day basis.
So, let me just because it came up just now, and we're almost done with we're almost out of time here, but like, I just want to unpack part of Will's question. You know, to me, watching the movie, one of the most striking things that is said is when Anthony says this thing relatively early in the film where he says that part of the reason that he decided to launch this campaign was because he was trying to do right by Huma, right? He says, essentially, I was trying to get my life back to normal, and normal for me is politics. And so, like, and the reason I was trying to get my life back to normal was because, you know, I was doing, again, that was a huge part of the objective, at least as he describes it in the movie, was to normalize their lives, and that the way to do that was to run for office again, right? Which, to me, is like a huge element underlying part of what Huma's role in the movie is, which is, I think, is a very kind of tragic figure throughout the movie. You see her with being humiliated and having the incredible, I think, grace and stoic kind of dignity throughout the movie. There are some incredibly painful scenes of her as the new scandals erupt. But I think, again, she comes across very well, I think, in the movie. But there's this tragic undercurrent because, on some level, he decides to run for mayor because he's trying to get his life back to normal for her, and then subjects her to all of this further indignity as this goes on. So I guess my question there is just simply to say, was that known to you at the time? Like, did you understand why Anthony was running for mayor? That was part of it? Or when you saw that in the movie, did you say, wow, like, that's really part of why he decided to do this?
So I think that just from a perspective, just as, you know, a human in the world.
as we all are, at least semi.
Speak for yourself.
I don't know. I don't know about this one yet. we'll decide later. I think that doesn't strike me as something so out there. I also think the movie is about relationships in a very interesting way, about the idea of this couple going through something on a public scale unknown to anyone, right? that they'd already gone through and dealt with in their private lives earlier.
Right.
And they'd done that already, and they had worked through it and got to a point where they felt okay about him running for mayor again. I think that the idea of him doing it for her and all this stuff, like, I think that that sort of makes sense if you just think about it from a perspective of having experienced great loss, if you will, that they wanted to get back to a day-to-day that felt like them again and that felt like what had been there prior. And I think that that's, isn't that what everyone does when big things happen, when tragic things happen in people's lives, when there are, you know, when you lose a family member, when people go through really difficult divorces, when people like lose jobs, these are all things that it is a, how do you right the ship, if you will, and get back on course, and what are the things that you need to do to make that feel like that again? It's less about the, I'm getting back into politics, and more about the, how do I get us back to a space that feels like us again? And I think for that, that doesn't seem that out there to me. I think that that just seems like something that people do in order to continue on with their day-to-day lives, because they have the right to that, just like everybody else does, to continue to live their life after they've gone through something and weathered that storm together.
I'm wondering, would you like to run another mayoral campaign after this?
You know, I think I want to go buy a puppy and take puppies to the park for a little while and name it Tyrone.
I think you could get like a dachshund and name it Wiener.
Oh, well, no. That's very funny. Good joke. Okay. Way to end it on a high note.
I groan every time.
It's a cheap.
Every time.
Good job, guys. Good job.
Don't look at me. Point at him, man. I groan at that every time.
Wiener dog.
This is like a comedy hour over here.
Hey, look, Wiener dog. Come here, Wiener dog. Oh, Wiener.
I want a rescue dog. A little rescue dog.
I want a rescue from his Wiener dog jokes.
I know, me too. Let's cut this.
I'm just too puerile for my own good.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think people will walk away from the movie thinking?
I think that if people go into the movie looking for an answer about why this happened, they're probably going to be disappointed. I think that there isn't necessarily an answer that's going to satisfy people on that front. I think that it's I think it's more of a movie to challenge your own perspective on why things happen and whether or not the information that is provided to you through the media is ever going to be enough, you know, because sometimes the why just isn't ever there, because you have in your mind a sense of, this is the only why of what will make sense to me. It's why people kept asking questions about, you know, do you think you need to go to therapy? Do you need to do these things? Because that's what makes sense to them. What is it? It's, you know, rationalism versus empiricism and, you know, Kant's world or whatever about how he talks about things. But it
That's the first time anybody has ever cited Immanuel Kant on this show. So that's kind of awesome.
I'm really up in the game here.
Yeah,
guys.
Really. Seriously. I'm making Wiener jokes and you're citing Kant.
I know. Okay. But that's the whole
point. Can you do the rest of the podcast with me after John? But
that's the point, is that it makes, you know, that there are, you know, we view the, you know, we come to decision, you know, to conclusions based on both our experience and then actual information, right? The idea of all these things combined in some algorithm. And I think that if people are only going to come to the conclusion based on, like, this medical thing is going to make sense to me versus, oh my goodness, I've experienced something where I just can't explain why it happened, and but I accept it as such. You know, that's where people are going to come out on it. And I think that that's what I would say, that you're not going to get an answer necessarily that satisfies everybody.
It's a great note to end on. And thank you, Barbara, thank you for coming, and thank you for saying those things. I think, you know, I will say, you know, just to put a button on this.
Yes.
I think the thing about what the movie opens today, on Friday, May 20th, and anybody who's interested in politics and campaign should see it. It's fantastic, as we said earlier in the podcast.
And it'll be on Showtime, I think, in like 3 or 4 weeks.
Right. So you'll have a lot of people, different possible places to go see this movie. But I think it's interesting. Barbara brings up a really relevant point, which is that it's not a psychological character study of Anthony Weiner. And there's a lot of revealing material. Revealing in the sense of, you see in a very candid, very raw way what it was like for Anthony to go through this thing, put himself through this thing, put everyone else through this thing. But you don't walk away thinking, oh, now I understand. why Anthony Weiner was this way. It's not a study of the psyche. It's more a study of the chaos of a campaign that is in an acute and maybe even uniquely acute kind of meltdown because of its principle. And many campaigns have gone through moments of crisis. And so there's some insight that is more generalizable from that. Again, this is a very unique experience because there's not really any campaign that's ever been like this one. But it's more about the culture of a campaign and more about the culture of crisis and understanding what that looks like from inside the maelstrom than it is like inside Anthony Weiner's brain. But no less interesting or valuable for anybody who cares about this kind of thing, because you don't ultimately walk away with, oh, now I understand Anthony Weiner. Here's Rosebud. You know.
I think it's a better movie because of it.
That's it for this episode of Culture Caucus. I'm still, amazingly, John Heilman.
And I'm Will Leach. I'm going to go get Barbara Morgan a rescue dog.
You are a much nicer person than me. and we are thrilled to have been here. We'll be back with you next time. We'll be talking about another incredible piece of documentary filmmaking in episode 11 of the Culture Caucus, which is O.J. Made in America, the new epic, incredible, multi-part, 7.5-hour documentary on the life and times of O.J. Simpson, race, policing, the trial, Los Angeles, everything you can possibly imagine in one of the more extraordinary pieces of long-form documentary we've ever seen. We'll talk about that next time on the Culture Caucus. For now, so long.
Bye, everybody.
Brought to you by Oppenheimer Funds, the right way to invest. Explore long-term opportunities at oppenheimerfunds.com.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.